This is the fourth day of this July 2010 seven-day session. We'll resume reading from the teachings of 12th century Chan master Wu Men, also known as Foyan. His Japanese name is Mumon, the compiler of the Gateless Gate, the Mumon Kan. He begins, "People may sleep on the same bed, under the same covers, yet their individual dreams are not the same. An ancient sage put it this way, we share the same one reality, yet do not realize it. For example, within the single reality of life and death, there are those who can enter into life and death without being bound by life and death, and there are those who are bound by life and death in the midst of life and death. In the midst of the same common reality, one person is bound while another is free. Is this not the individual difference in the dreams? So, one we call enlightened, the other we call not enlightened. But the reality they share is this true nature. Another Chinese master once put it this way, the ordinary person, and by that the person who thinks she's unenlightened, the ordinary person is someone who's enlightened the whole day long without knowing it. This is the fundamental bedrock of faith in Zen and in Buddhism. It's that what is common to all of us is this bright, luminous, enlightened nature. All of us, without exception. Or as we said earlier in Sesshin, there is only this enlightened nature. There's one test of awakening. It is whether you see that you've gained nothing. You have nothing that everyone else doesn't also have. It's not something that can be gained or lost because it is the ground of it all. And awakening also reveals that enlightenment itself is a kind of a dream. A dream in that as soon as we say enlightenment, we're setting up a dualism, enlightenment and non-enlightenment, and that makes it a dream. Sleeping on the same bed, under the same covers, but with different dreams. He continues, you usually make birth and death into one extreme and absence of birth and death into another extreme. By the way, birth and death, this is this actually, it means samsara, the realm of the realm we can describe as the realm of change, of flux. And we don't want to get caught into thinking of birth and death just literally, the act of birth and the act of drawing one's last breath. No, in Buddhist texts, it means much more than that. It means the whole continual shifting, varying mental states and moods and thoughts in our mind. So we're trafficking in birth and death all the time, because that's the nature of the mind. It's the nature of reality, is this flux. But to continue, you usually make birth and death into one extreme and the absence of birth and death into another extreme. Or we could say you make change, you put change at one end of the scale and the changeless at the other end. You make thinking into one extreme and non-thinking into another extreme. You make speech into one extreme and non-speech into another extreme. Here I have neither the business of Zen monks nor anything transcendental. I just talk about getting out of birth and death. So, seeing beyond the world of change. Who would not want to do that? Who would not want to see the changelessness in change? The realm in which everything is at rest, silent. The great master Yongjia visited the sixth patriarch of Zen and said, "The matter of birth and death is serious. Transitoriness is swift." The sixth patriarch said, "Why not grasp the birthless and realize what has no speed?" Yongjia said, "Comprehension, understanding itself is birthless. Realization of the fundamental has no speed." Let's look again at this realm of birth and death, or samsara, the realm of change. We see it all the time. We experience it painfully if we think of it as loss or deterioration. We see it in aging. The body deteriorates, the mind deteriorates, usually very gradually, but inexorably. We see it in our houses. House homeowners know that there will always be something that needs to be repaired or replaced. In our cars, the same thing. In our families, our relationships, things are always deteriorating. The Buddha taught that this is the nature of reality. There is the arising, there is the existing, there is the decaying, there is the dying or the passing away, and then there is the re-arising. This is the round of birth and death. You see it everywhere in Buddhist texts. Round of samsara. It is a real tipping point in one's practice when one says, all right, I'm really caught in this web. There seems to be no way out. And yet, the Buddha, through his great enlightenment, found a way out. It's not resisting the inevitable decline and deterioration of our bodies and minds and houses and buildings and relationships and friendships. You can't resist that, but there is a way that we can transcend the deterioration, the loss. And ultimately, it is only through awakening to the non-dual nature of change and changelessness. And of course, that means a lot more than thinking about it intellectually. One of the most often quoted passages from the Diamond Sutra. The Diamond Sutra is one of the Buddhist scriptures that is most esteemed in Zen. And this has been quoted for centuries. It goes like this. Reflect that all conditioned dharmas in a plural here means things, all conditioned dharmas are like these: a star, a mist, a burning lamp, a phantom, a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash, and a cloud. That is, that all conditioned things, which means everything we can imagine, all conditioned things are subject to change and have no substance, ultimately, no substance to them. This is the evanescence of worldly existence. In Taisho once, Roshi Kaplow, in talking about this matter of the ephemeral nature of reality, saying, row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. We're all in that stream. We have to come to terms with it. And we have to face the fact that the stream goes over a waterfall. What are we doing about that? Wu Men tells another dialogue here. When Cao Shan took leave of Dong Shan, these are two great masters from the Tang Dynasty, Dong Shan asked, "Where are you going?" Cao Shan replied, "To an unchanging place." Dong Shan retorted, "If it is an unchanging place, how could there be any going?" Cao Shan replied, "The going is also unchanging." This can sound like just so much inaccessible talk until we reach a state where the mind falls silent, when thoughts fall silent, then we realize, we even short of awakening, an experience like that reveals this realm in which, right in the world of change and flux, there is something which is unchanging. And the something is not a thing. And he says, why not practice Zen in this way? Walk, stand, sit, and recline all day long without ever walking, standing, sitting, or reclining. Sometimes seekers come here, utter a phrase, and clap their hands. How does this amount to an understanding beyond dualistic extremes? You should think in this way. And then he poses the line of reflection. Clearly, I am in the midst of birth and death. How can I get free of birth and death? Don't say this itself is it, that you basically have no birth or death. It is not realized by your uttering this statement. He says there are those who hear someone say there is no birth and death, he's referring to a teacher, for example, and immediately say, right, there is originally no birth or death. If you make your interpretation in this way, it will be impossible to understand. What he means is it would be impossible to fully realize this great matter so long as we just spout these statements without the real experience, or even with the experience, but a very shallow experience. There's a Zen saying, a little wisdom prevents enlightenment. You could say that a small opening prevents great realization sometimes. If we rest in that, if we become complacent in whatever piddling awakening we may have had. He offers us an analogy here from his own teacher. He said, "My teacher said, suppose a bit of filth is stuck on the tip of the nose of a sleeping person totally unknown to him. When he wakes up, he notices a foul smell. Sniffing his shirt, he thinks his shirt stinks, and so he takes it off. But then whatever he picks up stinks. He doesn't realize the odor is on his nose. If someone who knows tells him it has nothing to do with the things themselves, he stubbornly refuses to believe it. The knowing one tells him to simply wipe his nose with his hand, but he won't. Were he willing to wipe his nose, only then could he know he was already getting somewhere. Finally, he would wash it off with water, and there would be no foul odor at all. Whatever he smelled, that foul odor wouldn't be there from the start. Practicing Zen is also like this. Those who will not stop and watch themselves on their own, instead pursue intellectual interpretation. But that pursuit of intellectual interpretation, seeking rationales and making comparative judgments, is all completely off. If you would turn your attention around and watch yourself, you would understand everything. As it is said, quote, when one faculty returns to the source, the six functions are all in abeyance. Now, the six functions refer to the six senses, which is how we apprehend reality normally. It is seeing that which is beyond seeing and hearing, smelling, touching, tasting, and thinking, the six senses, that delivers us from being bound to the senses and our reactions to them. When he says, if you would turn your attention around and watch yourself, this is really the essence of Zen practice as a method. It's taking our attention off of objects, which mostly means our thoughts, and turning it around 180 degrees and seeing this one, the subject, the one who sees, the one who hears, the one who thinks. skipping around here some. There's a lot of material here that just isn't quite suited to be read. One must be like 30 tons of iron, which cannot be pulled forward or pushed back. Only then do you know it's the real thing. People like you stir the minute you're shaken by someone. One more push and you tumble. Of course, he's alluding to our vulnerabilities, how we react to circumstances, to what people say, what people do, the way we take offense, or the way we react with anger or hurt. This all, of course, comes from attachment to the self, to our self-image that we have acquired. You should be so perfectly clear that you see your 360 joints and 84,000 pores open up all at once. Inside your body and outside in the physical world, every phenomenon is the original reality. Nothing is not it. Only then will you get it. This be like 30 tons of iron which cannot be pulled forward or pushed back. This is the unshakable position of one who has seen clearly through self and other. Until we have some degree of awakening, we are always vulnerable because we construe the world as one of division. The self here and everything else out there. And almost inevitably, we are vulnerable to seeing other, anything besides ourselves, as potentially menacing. But to awaken to the fact that everything is our own mind, our own nature. Well, to whatever degree we awaken to that, we will have this grounding, this balance. We're not thrown by circumstances. There is a designation in Buddhism called the Eight Winds. See if I can remember them. These just came to mind. They're four pairs of positive and negative circumstances or conditions. Praise and censure or blame. Ill repute and fame. Gain and loss. And something else. But these are the things that all of us, to some degree, are can shake us. We may practice for years and years and years and feel a greater stability, even a measure of equanimity, clarity, non-defensiveness. But these eight winds can then, the strong gust can topple us. Not permanently, but it's very sobering when this happens. People with clear eyes do not settle complacently into fixed ways. The reason you haven't attained this in everyday life is simply that your eyes are not clear. If your eyes were clear, you'd have attained it. That is why it is said that people with clear eyes are hard to find. As soon as you say, "This is thus and so," that is a complacent fixation. People with clear eyes are not like this. This is a little vague, but he's warning us not to ever think that we know how things are. This is the way. That is, know in a way that we can put it into words. That is a position of abiding, of attachment, to make statements like that. This is how things are. This is the truth. Because anything we say can't be the whole truth. Once it's in words, it can't be the truth in its wholeness. For example, saying the nature of reality is one. Well, that's true as far as it goes, but it's also many. Or to say we're all equal. Well, that's half the truth. The other is that we're all different. Each one of us is different. Or to say we all equally share this enlightened nature. Yes, but... Why is it that we tend to want to hang on to what we think we know? Well, because a state of not knowing or non-abiding is one of basic instability or insecurity, so it seems. But it's actually the ultimate security, is holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in prajna wisdom. This expresses itself in a state of wondering. And this wondering is a precondition of awakening. Say Socrates, who said, "Wisdom begins in wonder." It's because the precondition of awakening is an empty mind, not a mind that is grasping at knowledge, thoughts. So wondering, or this non-abiding in anything, is the precondition of awakening, and it's also the effect of awakening. Because awakening reveals the groundless nature of things, that everything, that we always can see reality from two sides. And as soon as we make a statement, it's limited. We've limited ourselves. There's a natural curiosity that is nurtured, that develops through long practice, even short of awakening. People who have cultivated this mind of non-attachment to this and that, are people with curiosity. They wonder a lot. Roshi Kapil used to be this way. He would so often just kind of with a just a natural ease just raise questions. Why would that be? How does that work? What's this all about? This is the mind, a big mind, a mind that is so open, so inclusive, that it is not ruling anything out. It's not excluding anything. Broad, clear, like the sky. And it's a mind of freshness, openness. That's always the nature of not knowing. It's the mind of a child. Buddha famously said, not this, not that. It's not this extreme, it's not that extreme. It's no single statement encompasses the whole of the truth. Now, this doesn't mean that the masters felt obliged to always talk about the other side. Sometimes they would speak in terms of oneness. Sometimes they would speak in terms of differentiation. And then later masters would look back and playfully say, well, he may say that all things are one. I say that all things are different. It would be pretty tiresome in giving Dharma talks to say, on the other hand, da da da. People who practice the path clearly know there is such a thing. Why do they fail to get the message and go on doubting? Let's break this down. People who practice clearly know there is such a thing. It is anyone who comes to practice, certainly anyone who comes to Sesshin, knows that there is a reality beyond our ordinary, what we can understand with our ordinary mind. We sense it. Everyone can almost smell it, this realm of enlightenment, this realm of transcendence, this reality that in other religions are maybe called God or Allah. There's something beyond, something more. And then he says, why do they fail to get the message and go on doubting? This skepticism, this lingering skepticism about what cannot be proven, what cannot be empirically proven. It never will be. It never has been. It's not in the realm of the empirical. It is because their faith is not complete enough, and their doubt is not deep enough. Their doubt is not deep enough. When doubt or questioning really is followed, then it can lead to something wonderful. But if it's just clung to as another position, I don't believe such and such, then it works against this wonderful, potent mind of questioning. Only with depth and completeness, be it faith or doubt, is it really Zen. If you are incapable of introspection like this, you will eventually get lost in confusion and lose the thread, wearing out and stumbling halfway along the road. But if you can look into yourself, there is no one else. Only with depth and completeness, be it faith or doubt, is it really Zen. So much of this comes down to simple faith. That's what really fuels the doubt, the need. Doubt meaning the need to understand. They're really inseparable, faith and doubt. If we have faith, then we will question why things don't appear to be in accord with what we believe, with our faith. But these two together fuel practice. Faith. Faith in the inherent completeness of things, that there is faith and that there is an order, there is something that ultimately is complete, and that something is our own self. Faith that it's nothing lacking, nothing in excess. And in terms of just the nitty-gritty of practice, it means faith in the practice. Faith that this practice, whether it's the breath or the koan, chikantaza, that the practice we're working on is the whole thing. That's all we need. We don't need to figure anything out. We don't need to believe anything except just that. Believe that that is the way out of this realm of birth and death. The simplicity, the utter simplicity of just move. Radically simple, uncomplicated. That it all comes down to seeing how we see. It's all a matter of perspective. In this very week, this session, every single one of us has the possibility of having our perspective changed in a very fundamental way. Awakening to this mind, this realm that is beyond our ordinary understanding, and seeing everything in a completely different way, fresh, mysterious, wonderful. What is it? What is it? We'll stop now and recite the four vows.